Everybody. My name is Abe Gold, and I am proud and pleased to welcome you this evening to our synagogue, Renat Yisrael of Plainview, where we are beginning a series of lectures that will continue, we hope, throughout the year, on the relevance, the importance of Judaism to our contemporary lives. The series will cover a vast array of subjects, and it will include guest speakers, as we have this evening, but it will also include many presentations by our new rabbi here at Renat Yisrael, Rabbi Reuven Mann. For those of you who have already received the flyers that we were going to hand out after the lecture, but I guess it's fortunate for me they were handed out now because I have trouble with all of these yeshivas. Rabbi Mann is is not just a pulpit rabbi, but he's an educator. And he is the dean of the Masoret Institute, which is an advanced institute, or an institute for advanced Jewish education for women. He's also a senior administrator at Yeshivat B'nai Torah, which is obviously for men. And his real interest in coming here to Plainview and in becoming the rabbi of Renat Yisrael is to further Jewish education, not only among the college-age students who attend his institutes, but also among the families out here in the Mid-Island area. Before we get down to this evening's lecture, the series that we're going to have is beginning here at 2 John Street at our synagogue, only because we had not finished organizing the series early enough. Beginning next week, the series is going to move to the Mid-Island Y. And we'll have a classroom at the Mid-Island Y on a weekly basis for the subjects that will be presented by Rabbi Mann. In order to introduce you to this evening's subject, which is a fascinating one, I'd like to introduce Rabbi Mann. I've already told you his background. Rabbi Mann.
Thank you very much, and I want to welcome everybody for coming here tonight. Just by way of introduction, I think that most of the Jews are familiar with the concept or the term of the righteous Gentile. And generally, you hear that term applied to individuals such as Raoul Wallenberg, I'm sure you're all familiar with, who've done mighty, noble, heroic deeds on behalf of Jews. I think there's a section in the Yad Vashem museum in Israel for the righteous Gentiles during the Holocaust. The question I would like to raise is, what is the Torah's concept? Is there a Torah perspective on the idea of a righteous Gentile? Judaism is very unique. Most religions are pretty much exclusive. That is to say that they're based on a certain series of dogmas, of beliefs, which determine if you follow those dogmas, you subscribe to those beliefs, and then you have salvation. And if you don't, so you suffer the consequences. It's not a universalist type of system. It's limited to those who follow the prescriptions of that religion. Judaism is different. Judaism is what I would call a universal system. That is to say that the Torah is not specifically directed just to Jews, but the Torah is directed for all of mankind. Within the framework of Torah, there are really two systems. There's a system that we refer to as, in Hebrew, it's Tayyag, the 613 commandments, and the Jews are obliged. Jews accepted the covenant at Sinai and became bound to keep the 613 commandments. But the Torah is not directed only at Jews. The Torah is directed at mankind. This is God's revelation, God's prescription for how people are to find perfection and meaning in terms of their life. There's another system which is referred to as the seven Noahide laws. And these laws were revealed, six of them were revealed to Adam, and the seventh was revealed to Noah. And this is what God demands, so to speak, of all people, that they subscribe and they live their lives in accordance with these seven basic laws. And if a person, someone who is not born Jewish, is not obligated to become Jewish. There are two kinds of conversion, in fact. The term for convert in Hebrew is ger. So we're familiar with, when we use the term ger, a convert, we assume he's become Jewish. However, there's another concept. It's called the ger tosha, the resident convert. It's a different kind of a conversion. That is an individual who accepts upon himself to live in accordance with the seven Noahide laws. That is a concept that I believe that most Jews are not familiar with. Now, what does the Torah say about an individual who lives his life in accordance with this system? I'm reading to you from the Rambam. The Rambam says that whoever accepts upon himself the seven mitzvot, the seven commandments, and is careful to keep them, this person, for those who are familiar with the Hebrew, is chasidei umos ha'olam. Chasid means someone who's very pious. He's a pious, righteous individual from the nations. So this would correspond to the Torah's idea of being a righteous Gentile. V'yesh lo chelek la'olam haba. And he has a share in the world to come. So according to Judaism, the ultimate reward that Judaism promises to those who follow the word of God is for all people. It's not limited, it's not exclusive only to Jews. This individual is fulfilling the will of God. He's living his life in accordance with what the Torah demands from him. Historically, there have been converts to Judaism in different periods. Today there's probably more converts than at any other time, but there's never really been a Noahide movement. And it's very rare to find individuals or groups of individuals that subscribe to this. And it's an interesting question as to why it's not the case. Many people ask the Jews, why don't we make this known? Well, why don't we publicize the idea of the seven Noahide laws? Well, there's many historical reasons for that. For most of the time, Jews, all their energies were preoccupied with self-preservation. However, in recent years, a new movement has arisen. And I don't know exactly how many years ago, there's a book on the subject, it's based in Tennessee, of people who I think essentially were raised as Christians, but as a result of their research, as a result of their study, they discovered that God's revelation is contained in the so-called Old Testament. And they began to remove themselves from their prior beliefs and to pattern their lives in accordance with living according to the seven Noahide laws. I just want to mention what they are for those who are not familiar. The seven Noahide laws concern idolatry, the renunciation of idolatry, a false god, to have a relationship purely to the God of heaven and earth, the God of creation, against blasphemy, murder, against forbidden categories of sexual relations, and against theft. And they also are obligated to maintain a system of justice in order to enforce all of the laws. So these are the basic categories of ethical and moral behavior, but it's all rooted in a renunciation of idolatry and a dedication to the God of reality. I met Doug Taylor at a convention, the annual convention of the Noahide movement in Athens, Tennessee, in 1995. He was attending. I don't think he would describe himself as a member of the movement. He was attending the worldwide conference. There were people there from all across the world, and I was one of the speakers there, and we met, and we spent many hours talking, aside from the classes that I had given over there, and I found him to be an extremely exceptional individual. I don't think he's part of a movement, but he bases his life on a real commitment to living in accordance with Torah, what God demands from him. And a part of his daily routine and his weekly routine includes serious Torah study. And in fact, the reason why he happens to be here tonight, last year he had a vacation, he came to New York to study in my yeshiva. So that's what he does in his spare time. And he had called me up a few weeks ago. He's involved in a change of jobs. He has some extra time. He decided to spend that time studying the Torah. So he has developed and cultivated a certain love and appreciation for Torah, which unfortunately many Jews today do not have. So it's my pleasure to introduce you right now to Doug, and I think it's very important for Jews to learn more about the idea of being an Holocaust and to hear his particular story. He has a very important story to tell, and of course we'll have time for question and answer afterwards. Doug lives in Seattle. He's an actuary and human resources consultant, and he's married to his wife Cal, and he has two children, 8 and 9, Daniel and Aaron. And it's my pleasure now to introduce you to our guest, Doug Taylor.
Pardon us while we adjust the technology here. Does that work?
Yeah, yeah.
We're there? Good evening. I really appreciate the opportunity to share some ideas and thoughts with you tonight. I particularly appreciate your coming out on an evening and allowing me the privilege to share my experience with you. In Torah, we are taught that the implications of a mitzvah or a good deed may be things that we never see. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about my own story, but in the course of that, I want to tell you about a key factor in that story, which was a young yeshiva student in Jerusalem who did a very good deed one day, had no idea what the far-reaching effects of that good deed would be for me, for my family, and hopefully for generations of my family to come. This happened in Israel about 11 years ago when I was there on an archaeological dig. And to kind of set the stage, I need to go a long ways back and start from being one of two kids raised in a typical American home, a very Christian family. We went to church almost every Sunday. We were what we would call, what I would call, mainstream Christians. It was what my parents were taught. It's what they taught me, and what I assumed that I would probably eventually teach my children. By the time I got to high school, I had become very involved in my local church. I was co-president of my high school youth group. I was involved in Bible studies, taking over for the youth director, getting different organizations or different study groups and activities together. And if you combine sort of the idealism of youth, the I'm going to save the world, with a little bit of Christian evangelism, I had the view that certainly God was working through all the Christians, and particularly if you really wanted to be where God was working in the known universe, you would be going to my church. So I was a huge amount of fun to be around in those days. But there was a crack in the armor that began to appear shortly after high school when I was so involved in activities that I simply almost burnt myself out physically and mentally. And I took a little vacation and went away and realized that despite all this running around and doing all these things, I had no real peace in my life. And I don't think I fully appreciated at the time, but I had no real knowledge. I just had a lot of things that I'd been told that I could spit back out. And if I was really, truly honest with myself, I had a lot of questions that I wasn't getting answers to. And that was the beginning of my kind of split away from the organized Christian religion. And I spent about the next 20 years in a long, circuitous travel, moving myself farther and farther away from Christianity. Most Noahides who have Christian backgrounds, and the ones that I know of virtually all do, have stepped away from Christianity, and it comes at a very, very slow pace usually. People don't wake up one morning and say, you know, I think there are all kinds of problems with this. I think I'll go hunt for the truth in the Torah. It's more a case of you start to ask questions, and then you ask a few more questions, and you ask a few more questions, and you have to pull yourself away a little bit at a time. And in my case, it took the better part of 20 years to do that. And in the course of that, I recognized that what the Christians call the Old Testament, which is approximately equivalent to the Hebrew Tanakh, was was truth, and I trusted that that was true, and I believed that God had chosen the Jewish people as his special nation. This New Testament stuff and Jesus and so forth, while at a time in my life I very strongly believed that, I began to look at it and step farther and farther away, and it was just one step after another of pulling myself out of that, till finally I realized I'd pulled myself completely out of mainstream Christianity. And I had the good fortune to get on the mail list of a former Baptist minister who had also ended up going to a yeshiva and had learned the rabbinic view of the Torah and how the Tanakh operates and the seven Noahide laws. And somehow I got on his mail list and began to read a little bit about that. And it kind of made some sense, and I began to put a few things together. And the man also happened to be an amateur archaeologist, and he was on the hunt for the temple treasures, which he believed were in a cave buried near Qumran, and that's based on his interpretation of a copper scroll, one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, but it's in a museum, I understand, in Amman, Jordan, the only scroll known in that period that's actually written on a sheet of copper, and it purportedly tells where the temple treasures are hidden. Now, whether the temple treasures are there in Qumran, I don't know, but at that time, he was organizing a dig, and this was about 11 years ago, and I got the information, and I thought, if you're ever going to go do some of these adventures in your life, you might as well go do it now, because otherwise you'll just keep putting it off. So I went and asked my boss for 6 weeks off, and somewhat, I guess, to my surprise, he said yes, which maybe should have told me something, but... So I went over and got involved in this archaeological dig. Now, there were about 12 or 15 of us on the dig team, and almost everyone had a Christian background in one form or another. Some were very zealous Christians. Myself, I was practically totally out of it, and just about everywhere in between, except for one man, and his name was Leonard, and he was Jewish. Now, why he was on that dig, I honestly don't know. Maybe he was just as interested as I was in finding the temple treasures. But he had a son going to yeshiva in Jerusalem who was in his, probably early 20s. And we were staying out at a kibbutz near Qumran, and the library facilities were limited. And his son would send out books to his dad to read. And his dad and I happened to be rooming together. And one of the books that he sent out was a slim little volume called The Path of the Righteous Gentile, which is an exposition of the rabbinic view of Torah, and a fairly detailed exposition of the seven Noahide laws, what they are, what they're about, a fair amount of specifics as to the different parts of them, and just kind of an overview in about 120 pages, really written not for Jewish people, but for non-Jewish people about what the Torah view of life is. And I picked that book up, and it was a little bit like someone who's been walking through the desert thirsty for 20 years and suddenly comes upon a beautiful, lush pool of endless depth. I began to read that book, and I would not let it go. I practically carried it with me wherever I could. It was borrowed. I had to eventually get it back. I scoured Jerusalem trying to find a copy, but it was out of print at the time. It's now back in publication by Feldheim. But it answered so many questions that had bothered me and plagued me over that last 20 years and before, that for me it was like tumblers falling into a lock. I was so excited about what I had discovered, and I realized in retrospect I had just begun to scratch the surface of what was in Torah and what was possible, but to me it was like finding a mountain of gold. I ended up calling the United States from Israel just to order books so that they would arrive at my home. When I got back to the States, so I'd have something to study, and I began a process of trying to figure out, okay, what are these laws, what's my obligation, what am I supposed to do, and how do I live a Torah life, and what does that mean anyway, because I really don't know, but I'm hungry to find out. I don't know if you've ever experienced it, but if you're having a discussion with someone or struggling through an idea, and somebody says something that is absolutely true, gets to the heart of the matter, truth absolutely cuts through everything else, and sometimes you can just almost feel it palpably. And that was what happened to me with these ideas. They just absolutely cut through, and I could see this makes absolute sense to me, and has to be the path of truth. So when I got back to the United States, And I should digress and say that the young man who sent that book out, I did not know him. He did not know me. We might have met, you know, sort of in passing when he came out to the Puts. But he was sending these books to his dad. He had no idea that I would pick this book up and no idea that it would eventually, that it would have the effect that it did and change my life and my wife's life and my children's lives and hopefully the lives of their kids for many generations. I got back to the United States and was fortunate enough to hook up with some local rabbis and find out that there were some other people in the United States that also were going down this path. And there were, in fact, as Rabbi Mann has indicated, there was a group of folks, one in Texas, one heavily based in Athens, Tennessee, a small little town in Tennessee, and they had a conference every year. And I attended that conference. Had an opportunity to meet Rabbi Chait of Yeshiva B'nai Torah, a couple other rabbis. At a subsequent conference, I had the opportunity to meet Rabbi Mann. And of course, as soon as I heard their approach and their expositions about Torah and the beautiful symmetry of how Torah works and the ideas behind it, that just further substantiated my desire to continually be involved in those ideas. So since that time, I've been able to hook up with some of their colleagues in the Seattle area and continue to study with them over about the last 8 or 9 years, since the early 90s. And that study continues to this day. I'd like to tell you a little bit about what it's like to be a Noahide. And by the way, this is not for me intended to be just a monologue lecture. You're welcome to ask any question you want, and truly any question you want. I may not be able to answer them all, but you can ask me anything you want. I'll do my best to answer it. My wife and I are attempting to raise our kids to be B'nai Noah. Sometimes I've not been totally sure what that means, because in one sense, there is no formalized B'nai Noach path. I mean, you have communities and you have shuls and you have traditions and the Shulchan Aruch and things that tell you exactly what to do in various situations and those kinds of things. Those resources either don't exist for Noachides or they exist only in a very small way. There is no large organized body of Noahides. There are Noahide groups scattered around the country, small little enclaves here and there. Again, a group in Athens, a group in Texas. I've heard there's some people in Ethiopia. I knew some people in Indiana. There were some people in New Jersey for a while. There are a couple of us families in Seattle, maybe more if I knew where they were. But part of the difficulty is finding these people. There are a number of people, I think, pulling away from Christianity and looking for the truth that Torah has, but it's tough to sort of smoke those people out and find out where they are, because they're pretty quiet. People who go down this path don't generally raise up a flag and advertise it a lot, because in their Christian communities that would not be appreciated very positively. So it's tough to find them. The internet is helping a little bit, and there's an internet group of people that, you know, email them back and forth and try to stay in touch. But we're trying to raise our family in that in the Torah path, trying to figure out exactly what that means for a Noahide. There are some challenges to that, and let me, you know, share a few things with regard to halakha and philosophy. From a halakhic standpoint, as Rabbi Mann pointed out, there are 7 Noahide laws, but the 7 Noahide laws are actually categories. I've spoken to, yes.
Doug, my name is Dave. I just want to ask you a small favor.
Sure.
Not everyone here tonight is Jewish.
Ah, okay.
So they may not know some of your Hebrew.
Okay.
So if you
let me translate in English then. Thank you for letting me know. The Noahide is a word that has come about to be sort of a categorization of people who are trying to follow the 7 laws of Noah. And if you kind of think back through your genealogy, we had the flood, then there was Noah. Noah had 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. They had kids, and their kids had kids, and their kids had kids. And if you follow the line down through Shem 10 generations, you get to Abraham. And Abraham had Yitzhak, and Yitzhak had Yaakov, and then we have the 12 tribes. I'm sorry? Well, I'm following the line down. Yeah, it's true. He had Ishmael as well. Following the line down, you have the 12 tribes of Israel. Well, in the meantime, all those people had a lot of other kids, too, who didn't end up in that line. And so all those people are sometimes considered Noahides or B'nai Noah, or sons of Noah, or children of Noah. I mean, in the world, if you break it apart, basically, there are Jews, and there are the children of Noah. I mean, anybody who is not Jewish is, by definition, one of the descendants of Noah, and halakhically or legally, in accordance with Torah, under the seven Noahide laws. In fact, I was talking at a New Jersey high school to some Jewish students earlier this week, and one of them said, well, how long have you been B'nai Noach? And I said to the group, I said, every one of you should be able to answer that question all your life. And then he asked the question, well, have you been practicing or trying to follow the seven laws of Noah? But the seven laws of Noah are really categories of laws. You know, the Torah prescribes for the Jewish people 613 commandments. Those commandments are very specific commandments. The seven Noahide laws are more categories of laws. There is six prohibitions, essentially, and one positive commandment. Prohibitions against idolatry, blasphemy, theft, murder, inappropriate sexual relations, eating the limb of a living animal, and then a positive commandment to establish courts of law. So, as one, I think, came up once talking to a high school group, they look at, well, 613, that's what we've got. You've only got seven. Well, it's like a pretty good deal to me. I said, well, now, wait a minute. Let's take this apart for a second. Because the seven Noahide laws are categories, in order to relate those back to specific commandments, we need to break them apart a little bit. And a gentleman named Aaron Lichtenstein wrote a book called The Seven Laws of Noah, where he tried to take the seven B'nai Noah laws, the categories, and map them back over to the 613 commandments to say, okay, how many specific commandments are really implied under those seven categories? And by the time he got all done, and opinions differ a little bit here and there, but just in round numbers, he came up that those seven Noahide laws really related to 66 of the 613 commandments. So then, partly to make the high school students feel a little bit better, I said, okay, now you have 613 laws, but a lot of those laws relate to things that don't apply to you today because the temple's not standing. And so if we go through and say, well, how many of the 613 mitzvot, the 613 laws of the Torah that apply to Jews, really are in operation? This one particular author came up with the number 271. Now, again, opinions may differ, but let's talk around numbers. That gets you, instead of a ratio of 613 to 7, which is 88 to 1, you're down to about 4 to 1, which is a whole lot better from their standpoint. So part of our obligation is to try to know and understand what those laws are, what our obligations are with regard to those, and do our very best to try to understand them and to keep them. So halakhically, that's our responsibility. Philosophically, what Noahides do is, from everything I can tell from my studies, the same thing that the Jewish people do. We work on our character. We work on perfecting ourselves. We try to study and learn and gain knowledge. We try to remove any idolatry from our lives in whatever form that might take, and basically try to grow. And that a Noahide can do pretty much just as much as a Jew can do. So there's great opportunity for Noahides to study and learn. There's lots of material out there that, though it was written for Jewish people, is eminently applicable to non-Jews. One of my favorite books is Duties of the Heart by I think it's Ibn Ben Pakuda. And, you know, you read through that, the lessons there apply virtually as much to a Jewish person as they do to a non-Jewish person. A friend just gave me a copy of Rabbeinu Yonah's Gates of Repentance. And as I go through that, I'm sure, there may be one or two things where I'll see, oh, no, that would be something specific for the Jews. But in general, the themes are all the same. Repentance and trying to do good deeds and, you know, work out the issues in your life that you have to work with. With regard to our family life, things get to be rather interesting because, to some degree, as I mentioned earlier, there's no real solid path, if you will, for Noahide to follow. There's no community. And so we have to kind of, if you will, make it up as we go along a little bit. Not in the sense that we have any right to make up anything outside of Torah, but we're trying to teach our children Chumash and the themes of Torah and try to teach them to be good B'nai Noach. And again, we're still, you know, uncovering exactly what that means. If you think about your lives, for those of you that are Jewish, I mean, you have holidays and you have specific things that happen on those holidays, and every week you go to shul, and there are things that are done every day in your home that continually inculcate the ideas of Hashem and Torah into your daily lives. For the most part, there are no such things for B'nai Noach, and to a large degree, we're not allowed to make any up. We can't add any new holidays or do anything like that. So we try to walk a pretty fine balance between being involved in a lot of things that most people would probably call Jewish, but without trying to sort of pretend like we're Jewish, if you will. On holidays, it depends on the holiday. Pesach is one that comes to mind. I can't do a Passover Seder. It would be very inappropriate for me to do that. I mean, my ancestors were not the ones that at Mount Sinai. So what we do is we get our kids together and we pull some books out and we study the ideas behind Pesach and what went on at that time and the history and what that meant to the Jewish people and the revelation given to Moses and so forth, and try to get them to understand the history and learn it ourselves. At Hanukkah, we light candles and we try to make a celebratory thing around that. So it depends on the holiday and how much direct application there is to a Noahide or not. Education is a challenge. We happen to live in Washington State, which is one of the, as I understand it, the two states in the United States that is most supportive of homeschooling, and so we homeschool our kids. So that gives us an opportunity to guide them in the paths that we want them to go. Yes.
Could you send your kids to a Hebrew day school?
Could I send my kids to a Hebrew day school? It really depends on the Hebrew day school and whether they would be open to that. And we're actually right at this moment, my boys are 8 and 9, and we're starting to think about, all right, what are we going to do about high school and college, and you know, could they go to yeshiva? And I've approached one gentleman who started a Jewish high school for boys, and said, you know, if my kids wanted to come, would you be open to that? And he knows me and what we're trying to do, and he said yes. And the biggest, I think, issues that we would have to get over would be, I would have to get them a basic foundation of Hebrew and Gemara education to the point where they would understand what's going on and be able to move along with the class, and the other would be whether they would have the internal motivation to want to do that. I certainly hope they will. That's something that we're trying to inculcate in them, but a lot will depend probably on them as we go along. There is a high school in the Seattle area, but it's co-educational, and so that eliminates the opportunity for my boys to be able to attend. Is everybody clear on why that's true? I mean, the school would not want boys, non-Jewish boys, going to a Jewish high school because there are girls there, because of the concern that there might become a relationship, and that would, of course, be an inappropriate relationship and not something that any of us would want to have happen. So they would draw the line on that and say, you know, that's just not a possibility, and I understand that, and that's acceptable, but there are all boys schools, and that issue isn't an issue there. So we're looking at that. As far as the Hebrew day school, I think it would depend on the Hebrew day school. This is one of the real difficulties or challenges that we're struggling with, because we thought, okay, if we send our kids to a Jewish day school, are they going to feel okay in that environment? Are they going to feel like they're a sort of outsiders, second class, you know? I mean, I'm sure the kids would be very nice, but yeah, I mean, people are going to say, you know, are they going to convert? Which way are they going to go, and why are they here? We've talked about moving into the Jewish community with the same kinds of questions. There are people in our Jewish, in the Seattle area Jewish community, who know us and who would welcome us coming. There are probably people who don't know us who would probably look a little bit like, what are you doing here, and what are you about, and why? And I couldn't blame them for feeling that way. I mean, this is a really, I guess, new and unusual kind of thing. So we're just trying to balance back and forth and say, okay, what's the best way to raise the boys, and what way do we want them to go? In a recent discussion, and my wife and I have not just confided this discussion to ourselves. I mean, we've discussed this with a number of rabbis that we have a high degree of confidence in, and gotten their opinions of, about what we ought to do. One rabbi spoke, and he said, have you considered the fact that if you converted, there is a better chance that your boys will follow in the Torah path because of all the community support than if you don't? He says, you know, you're real strong where you are, but you're kind of a lone ranger of a sort. And I agree with his statement. And at the same time, the kind of counter to that is that we didn't want our boys to get to a place where they said, well, you know, I'm Jewish because when I was 8, Dad decided we should become Jewish. I would rather that I built them up with a foundation of Torah and hopefully an ability to think clearly through ideas and let them make their own choice when they reach majority age. When I speak in high schools, one of the first questions, and I'll just anticipate it and answer, is, well, why don't you just convert? And that's a multi-factor. Nobody was going to ask that, right?
I would have gotten it.
Yeah, okay. It's a multifaceted question. Once upon a time, one rabbi told me, he said, you shouldn't convert unless you can't live without it. You know, you have to be Jewish. Well, I don't have to be Jewish. I mean, no offense to anyone in the audience, but when I look at the seven Noahide laws and all the character development stuff in the Torah and all the things there are in Gemara that relate to those things that I'm allowed to study, there's plenty of material to keep me busy for a long time. So it's not an overwhelming thing for me. At times I've thought, you know, if I were single and I didn't have family issues, and, you know, in some ways it would make it easier, because then I wouldn't be just kind of hanging out here trying to find my way along. But the flip side of that is, as Rabbi Mann pointed out, you know, religions generally are clubs. If you want to be a Mormon and go to heaven, you got to convert and be a Mormon. If you want to be a Catholic and get to heaven, you need to be a Catholic. And everybody wants you to be part of their club. The Torah, as I understand it, has never taken that position. The Torah's position is, you know, the Jews are God's chosen people, chosen for a specific reason, for some specific missions. But you got the rest of the world out here too. And I find nothing in Torah that ever suggests that the end goal of all of Torah is that the entire world should convert and become Jewish. I think there is an end result that the entire world will bow down and accept Hashem as the one and true and only God. But I never see anything about they'll all convert and become Jewish. So I look at that and say, okay, I was born a Noahide, so there must be a place for me here. There must be something I'm supposed to do, or a path I'm supposed to be, or this must be a state that's okay to be in. There seem to be so many of us. And so I'm trying to figure out how to be the best I can be at that. Now, one of the high school kids that I was talking to the other day asked the question, well, would you be open to converting? And I said, absolutely, down the road. I mean, things can change. I mean, my knowledge level changes as I study and learn, and I could always decide on a different path at a later point in time. But at this point in my life, that's the decision that my wife and I have come to, is just to stay on this path and try to raise our kids in this. Yes, ma'am.
Was your wife along with you on the path, and also Excellent question. Well,
let me repeat it for the tape. Was my wife on this path, when we first met, and how has that gone, and what's been the effect on my extended family? I got married just at the very beginning of getting on this path. And at that time, I would probably say that my wife was not as far down this road as I am. To my great fortune, she saw the truth of the Torah path in a very, very short time. And in fact, very interestingly, Rabbi Morton Moskowitz, who is a rabbi in Seattle who I've had the privilege to study with, made the statement to her one day, and at the, I think at the end of one of our classes or when he came by for a visit, he said, "I can prove to you that the Torah life is the best life." And we're not talking about world to come. We're talking about right here and now living. The Torah life is the best life. And as we went on in class after class after class and walked through idea after idea after idea, she came to a place where she said, "He proved it to me." And so she's been very, very supportive. I'm extremely fortunate. I sometimes look back and wonder, you know, how in the world was I so fortunate to find someone that would support this this path? But I have been, and she supports it greatly. Family is an interesting situation. It's kind of a split thing. My own parents have come to an almost similar place that we are, albeit by a slightly different route. And I think almost every person that comes, Noah Hyde, who comes out of Christianity and ends up on the Torah road, comes at it in a slightly different way, but the paths all have some commonality. So they're very supportive of what we're doing. So I don't get any heat or flack from there. Other members of my family have perhaps had a more difficult time with that because they are either Christian or Catholic or a little bit of a mixture of those. And I think it's been difficult for them because they don't fully understand it. We haven't had a lot of in-depth discussion around it. And it particularly became an issue around holidays, Christmas being the biggest, because Christmas in that particular family was a very, you know, everybody gets together on Christmas. And I haven't celebrated Christmas for probably 20 years or more. We don't celebrate it in our home. And that was a tough one. But we said, look, this is what we're, you know, this is what we're going to do. We'll get together with you at other times. We'll do Thanksgiving. We'll, you know, whatever it might be. Well, they could. So basically, it's been, it was a little tougher in the beginning, and now we've established kind of where we are enough that it works along pretty well. I will tell you that, again, I've been very fortunate in that respect, and there are other people who are not so fortunate. Noahides who have faced, you know, practically being thrown out of their families for wanting to go down the Torah path. I went to one Noahide convention where a man stood up and I think a number of people in the audience were practically in tears because he said, "I am facing losing my wife and my daughters over this. And on the one hand, I can't ignore the truth. And on the other hand, my family is so staunchly Christian that I'm going to lose my family if I do this, and I don't know what to do." The man was just in a horrible quandary. So it's a very difficult position, particularly if one member of a family or one member of a couple starts to ask some questions and steps away from Christianity and the other one doesn't. It's very tough to go down two ideological paths and try to maintain the family together. And it's a real difficult problem for folks. So again, I happen to be very fortunate in that regard. Yes?
I don't know if this is a question that I'm going to understand the answer to, but and I don't know if you have an answer to it, but was there a central difficulty or was there a central divergence between you and the principle of Christianity, or what was it in Christianity that so, or was there no one thing?
The question for the tape was there one thing in Christianity that became sort of the major stumbling block that opened things up, or was there not one? For me, there wasn't one. It was a very, very slow stepping away from little bits and pieces or separate books of the New Testament. And just to give you a little Christian background, the Old Testament, again, is the Hebrew Tanakh. The New Testament is where all the Jesus stuff is. And if I can put it in those terms. And there are a bunch of different little books, you know, like there are in the Tanakh. And because of some historical studies that my family and I were involved in, we began to look at and say, well, you know, this book was written before a period when this happened, so this really doesn't apply to us. And then, well, now that we said that, you know, this book doesn't really apply to us. And slowly but surely, we realized we were backing ourselves out of the New Testament. I never could understand the idea, I think through and through, of if the Christian position being that Adam sinned in the garden, and therefore everybody's lost, and so by this guy Jesus dying, somehow that saves me if I will just believe that, and that takes care of me, and I'm sort of back in the groove, so to speak. I will. That's my ticket to heaven. That didn't. After I went on for a little while, the more I looked at that, that didn't make a lot of sense to me. Particularly once I was exposed to the Torah position of you're judged on the basis of your deeds, which made a whole lot more sense.
Yeah, I'm going to follow this because I'm trying to understand this from. Isn't it the way you see Christianity that it is? It's a little too dogmatic or a little too automatic, or it's not about you and who you are, but it's about some specified landmarks that you just have to touch. Am I being clear?
You mean in order to in order to conform to Christianity?
Yeah, it seems to me every Jew's trying to get to some place, but they're all doing it a little bit differently and coming at it a little differently with some basic principles, and it's all about character development through our adherence to these laws.
Right.
It from your description of Christianity, you're seeing it as people have to conform to a particular belief, and it isn't about character development, it's about belief.
Yes, and again, let me repeat for the tape. The question is, in Christianity, is it more about belief than it is about the Jewish approach of continual character development? And the answer from my experience is absolutely yes. The Torah approach of continual character development and continual growth and continual learning and knowledge is completely different than the Christian approach, which is believe that Jesus died for your sins. If you do that, you're in. That's it. And there are groups that will say, you know, now you want to somehow be a better person and do those types of things, but there isn't anything like the emphasis on character development, on learning and knowledge. In fact, there is an interesting statement in the New Testament which suggests that it is laudable, this whole idea that you're going to be saved by believing that this guy died for you. I mean, the New Testament is saying this. It is kind of a wacky idea, my choice of words, and that's a laudable thing, that, you know, our faith is what is going to save us. So it is belief in an idea that saves you, not whether you develop yourself, whether you do good deeds or that type of thing. And I got into a very lengthy both written and oral discussion with a Christian woman a number of years ago, where she said, you know, basically, you're saved if you believe this. And I said, well, now, wait a second. You mean to tell me that someone who has, you know, killed, murdered, raped, pillaged, plundered people in the Inquisition that did such horrible things and tortured people and so on and so forth, if they just believe in Jesus, all that's going to be forgiven and they're going to heaven. But this guy over here who's done good deeds for people all his life and tried to help the poor and so on and so forth, he's going to hell? You're going to tell me that? Well, then she said, well, but once you accept Jesus, then you have to keep Jesus' commandments. I said, now, wait a second. You didn't say there was anything about commandments. And she was very, very caught up in a tremendous number of contradictions in what she was saying. It was an internally contradictory position. But she couldn't see it because the emphasis in Christianity is on belief, not on knowledge. And that's a hugely different approach. And that's why, as I was explaining to some of the high school kids the other day, that's why it's so very, very difficult to break out of Christianity, because the idea is that you've got, at least in the mainstream of what I was exposed to, and there are branches of Christianity that range from, you know, here to there. So, but that you have to believe, and you've got to believe this thing absolutely. And in some groups, if you question it, well, you know, you may not be saved. So you are faced with the intellectual dilemma that if you even think about the possibility that your position is incorrect, you may be destroying your eternal future. So you're scared to go there. You're scared to mentally even consider the idea that maybe this isn't really true. And it's a very tough place to be able to move people away from. So, does that answer your question? Yes, sir.
Getting back to Noahide, could you describe how you celebrate the Sabbath and how you go about communicating with God when you don't need to do that?
Okay. Question is, could I describe how we celebrate the Sabbath and how we communicate with God? A Noahide is not allowed to keep Shabbos in exactly the same manner as a Jewish person. And there is it's a very lengthy subject as to why that's true, and I've heard it discussed and espoused, and I understood it when I heard it, but our time limits us that I don't remember it well enough to be able to go through the whole thing, and number two, we don't have the time to do that. But it is, that's a well-established halakhic or Torah legal principle. So a non-Jewish person can do everything, if they choose to, that a Jewish person would do on Shabbat, but you need to break the work law at least once. Flip a light switch on, strike a match, do something. So that's what's allowed. Now, you ask specifically what I do. Based on my discussions with... Well, there is no established Noahide approach. And this, again, gets into different people do different things depending on who their teachers are and what their teachers suggest to them. What I try to do, and it's a bigger struggle sometimes than I wish it was, but is to focus on the purpose of the day, which is really to be involved in the study of Torah and in learning. And so I try to set some time aside, both for myself and with my kids, to focus on some Torah study for that day. I do not attempt to keep Shabbos in the same manner as a Jewish person might, you know, with the exception of one thing. That might be something that would happen down the road, but I haven't chosen to do that as yet. Your second question is, what do we do about prayer? The Christian approach I was raised with is basically emotionally spontaneous prayer. You basically stand up and talk to God like you would talk to your neighbor. It's not the Torah approach. And so I've taken upon myself to pray each day the blessings before the Shema, and the Shemona Esrei. So I'm following somewhat in the path of what the Jews would do with regard to prayer. In English, only because I haven't mastered Hebrew yet to a point where I can speak it, although I'm working on it. I've been working on it for a number of years and would love to be able to say those prayers in Hebrew. That would be, for me, a very special thing. That's something I took upon myself. We had at one of the Noahide conferences I attended where I was a speaker. They had a panel of us, and one of the questions asked was, well, what do you guys do with regard to prayer? And there were three of us on the panel. I got three different answers. So one guy prays three times a day, but he doesn't pray the prayers out of the prayer book. I forget what the third gentleman did, and then my approach was to, at that time, was to pray the Shemona Esrei in the morning.
There's a prayer in the Shemona Esrei that's really an anti-Christian prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Do you include that?
I do. In fact, in the Aleinu, one of the high school kids came up and asked me just a couple days ago. He said, in Aleinu, I forget the exact wording, but...
They bow down.
Yeah, they bow down to things that are, which are, you know, vanity and which aren't a god and so forth. And he said, do you say that? I said, yeah. He says, does it bother you? I said, no, it's true. I mean, they do. I mean, that's what the nations in general do. So I'm not bothered by that, and I do say it. So, Rabbi, you had a question.
I was just wondering, you don't have to answer if you don't want
to. No, it's okay.
As a religious person, as a Noahide, who was very serious about his religion, what's your reaction, A, to the majority of Jews who don't seem to be quite as scrupulous, and B, if you would mind, I'd just like just talk for a moment, how do you react to the what's going on in the Middle East?
Okay. First question is, how do I react to Jews who are, I believe you said, not necessarily scrupulous?
Their observance.
And second, how do I feel about things going on in the Middle East? The answer to the first question is that I think initially, when I first began to see the Torah path, and I saw that there were non-observant Jews or Jews who perhaps didn't take Torah study quite as seriously as I might have thought they might, I was surprised. Because my reaction was, you folks have this tremendous treasure. How can you not want to be involved with this? And over time, what I've come to realize is that people are people, and that different people struggle with different challenges in life. People have good days, people have bad days, and some people may have been raised in Judaism in the same way, or in such a way that to them it's just, well, yeah, I'm Jewish because I was raised Jewish, and they, not having maybe been outside of it and seen it from a different perspective, they don't realize the enormous treasure they have. So I try to give them the benefit of the doubt. And with regard to the Middle East, the Middle East is sad. I can't say that I'm, up to the minute informed on everything going on over there. But I'm not at all, not really surprised that there's a problem. There was the famous handshake of Yasser Arafat and the Prime Minister, I believe, of Israel. Everyone thought that would bring peace. So now, let's say you just, you snapshot from that picture, and now you snapshot to the picture of Yasser Arafat and whoever is in peace talks with, or trying to have peace talks with somebody. You say, well, gee, I thought this was supposed to bring peace, and it obviously is not, and I don't suppose that should come as any big surprise. I think it's sad and tragic. What is very interesting, if I may elaborate on that point a little bit, when I was in Israel in 1989, I believe, I went to the Western Wall, and there's a gentleman there who I think is just there to make sure that people get steered to the right spot on the wall, and they had kapos and a place to wash, if I recall. And for whatever reason, I'm all by myself, and I just wandered in and looking at this. And he started talking to me. And I don't know if he was clearly Jewish and Israeli. I don't know why he began to talk to me, but he talked to me nonstop for probably somewhere between 20 and 40 minutes. And I thought, okay, I'll just stand here and listen. And I caught about 80% of what he was saying because it was in broken English, and I was having a little bit of time following him. But he had a couple of major messages, themes in what he was saying. One of them was that he saw himself as one speck in the sea of humanity that has come before him and will go after him. And he said, if I teach my kids peace, and they teach their kids peace, and they teach their kids peace, and they teach their kids peace, maybe someday we'll have peace here. The other thing that bothered him, that he was really upset about, was the way the American news media portrays what's going on in Israel. And I remember that the news reports of what was happening over there when I got back and shortly before was different than what I experienced when I was over there. And so I probably have, I don't know if it's a biased view, but maybe an experienced view. People over here in the West think, and this is my Doug Taylor opinion, think that everybody over there wants peace. Well, we went on a tour, our little group, in a Volkswagen van to a place just outside the city wall. Came out, and the back taillights of our car had been smashed. And as we stood there, and the hill going up to the city wall was behind us, suddenly you heard this plop, plop, and we realized that there were people up there throwing rocks at us. Now, we had, I believe, a car with an Israeli license plate on it. And I walked away from that experience and I said to myself, and maybe this is an unfair conclusion, I said, if I just walk into a place and I've done nothing to anybody except the possibility that I'm spending money in your city, and you throw rocks at me, you can't tell me you want peace. I'm not so sure that these were, as far as I could tell, either Palestinians or Arabs that were doing this. I'm not so sure that what many folks in the West think is true, that gee, everybody wants peace, is really so true over there. And visiting there and seeing the security measures that have to be taken so that Israel can be protected, it gave me a real different viewpoint on all that. How it's going to turn out, I have no idea, and I hope it does not cost a lot of Israeli lives. Yes, sir?
So before, when you pray, you said brachos and shema and etc. There are a lot of points where it references the Jewish people themselves, as opposed to everyone else.
Yes.
You change that language, or you adjust it for...
Yeah, the question is, and when I say the prayers, there's a lot of language in the prayers that is specifically refers to, for example, our forefather Abraham and so forth. And do I change that? And the answer is yes. I've gone through and made subtle adjustments to, say, Israel's forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, wherever it's appropriate, so that I'm not making any untrue statement in the prayers. And it doesn't take a lot, and I don't want to take liberties with the prayers, but I've changed them enough so that hopefully I've gotten all the spots so that I'm not making any kind of incorrect statement. Yes, sir?
Back to your family situation.
Yes.
How do you anticipate your social life in the communities? You mentioned before they can't go to a co-ed or Jewish school, for instance, because of that reason. So you wouldn't want them to have Christian friends, perhaps, but you can't have them have Jewish friends. I mean, what will happen?
That's a very good question. The question is, what am I going to do when my kids approach the teenage years, and how am I going to balance that of what kind of friends they have? And I'll carry your question a little further of, when we start getting into relationships and them wanting to date, or maybe we can try to avoid dating altogether, but I don't know if I'll be that lucky.
It's not enough. I should have said it.
Yeah. It's a very difficult question, and I don't have a good answer for it. What I am, almost every day since they were young, I have prayed specifically about the issue of wives for them, because I don't know where they're going to come from. Now, if you'd asked me 12, 13 years ago, you know, where would I ever find a Gentile woman who would go down this path with me, I would have said, that's an impossible thing. And it happened. Now, how it happened and, you know, circumstances versus some assistance from, you know, on high, I have no idea. What I hope to be able to do is train them well enough to think clearly enough and see the long-term consequences of their decisions, that they will make good choices. And I would like to hope, I mean, at 8 and 9, let's say I've got maybe, if I'm lucky, about, you know, 7 to 9 years before they're going to be pushing to date, if they're not pushing before that, or you know, interested in young women. Maybe I will be able to hook up with enough other Noahides around the country to be able to say, hey, I have a son. He's, you know, looking. Do you have any daughters out there? I hope that that will happen. There's always the possibility my kids will convert, and, you know, then that won't be such a big issue. But it's a very difficult problem, and I honestly don't have a good game plan. I wish there was one. I'm hopeful about making some contacts, and I'm hoping that there may be some people out there, or there is the possibility that, you know, they might become friends with someone who was, you know, perhaps open to Torah ideas, whether they were former Christian or something, and they could be instrumental in leading them down that path. That would be a nice thing if it happened. I certainly wouldn't want to bet my bank account on it. So it's a tough one, and I don't have a real good answer for it. I'd be open to any suggestions that you know, anyone would have.
Earlier, you said when the word of Noah was that the shouldn't commit blasphemy. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, the question is, what does the law of blasphemy really mean to a Noahide? The small amount that I have studied through the aid of some rabbinic scholars in that arena suggests that blasphemy is pretty narrowly defined as and in the Torah, when they're or in the court, when they brought someone forth and had to have testimony about a case of blasphemy, they would never use Hashem's name, so they would use the name Yossi and go through the entire court proceeding, and then at the very end, so that no one would you know, commit blasphemy in the course of the whole court proceeding, then at the very end they would take everybody out of the court except the judge and I think the two witnesses, and then one of the witnesses would say, okay, this is exactly what I heard this guy say, and I believe then the rabbis would tear their robes and you know, they had a specific procedure they followed. But my understanding is that, and I am no halakhic expert in this area, but that to actually be guilty of blasphemy, you have to say something of the form of may Yossi strike Yossi, where, you know, you would substitute the name of Hashem for Yossi. So it's a very specific formulation, and I believe that in order to be convicted and sentenced to be executed in a Torah court, you have to have at least two witnesses, and someone has to have been there and warned the person, do you realize that by saying this you are committing a capital crime for which you can be executed? No, it's saying that may the name of God curse or destroy the name of God. In other words, it's not just just saying it one time. My understanding of saying the one of the popular phrases that people would use is not considered blasphemy in the strict Torah legal sense. Certainly probably not a good idea to get in the habit of. So it's not something that I think would probably, as a practical matter, come up too often in modern usage of language.
Sure.
There's no stupid question.
No. Jews follow Judaism. Christians follow Christianity. What do you call the...
That's a very good question. If Jews follow Judaism and Christians follow Christianity, what are we? There's no real good word. If I walked out to 50 people on the street and said, "Hi, I'm a Noahide," they wouldn't have the foggiest idea probably what I was talking about. What I do, and I do it, you know, it kind of comes up every once in a while. We will tell people, you know, well, I study with some Jewish rabbis. And oftentimes I will specifically add to that, and I'm not Jewish and I don't need to become Jewish. The reason I do that is because, or part of the reason I do that is because as soon as they hear, well, you study with rabbis, people love to slot you into categories. Categories make it very easy for us to think. And so we say, oh, he's Jewish. End of discussion. Or, oh, he's going to become Jewish. And somebody wrote, an author whose name is escaping me, has written a lot of books about creative thinking. And one of them, he wrote a very interesting statement. He said the purpose of thinking for most people is so they can stop thinking. Because as soon as they come up with a category of an answer or some answer that fits the circumstances, they say, oh, okay, that's it. And they stop right there. They don't carry it any further. And so I would rather people didn't put me in a box like that. Because as soon as they do that, they'll stop thinking about it. If I say, I'm studying with some rabbis and I'm not Jewish and I don't intend to become Jewish, that doesn't fit in anybody's convenient slot. And hopefully that then starts them thinking, well, why are you doing that? And that then potentially is an opening to, you know, talk a little bit about some of the ideas we discuss and what we get out of it. There is not. There's not. It would be just Torah.
This is a fascinating discussion that we'd like to continue, but we have to pause now. We're going to invite everybody to go upstairs for refreshments, and if you want, you can talk to Doug. We're going to, I'm going to call Eileen to make a few announcements, but after that we're going to be davening Ma'ariv, and everybody who's davening or whatever can go upstairs for refreshments, and we'll all be joining for refreshments upstairs. At this time, I just want to express my gratitude for a very fascinating discussion, and I want to call on...
Thank you. Can I have one more minute?
One more minute? Sure.
Can I have one more minute? Because I want to kind of circle around and finish up a point that I started at the very beginning. And that is, I said to you that there was this young man in yeshiva who did this good deed by sending these books out to his dad, and one of them happened to be The Path of the Righteous Gentile, which had a tremendous impact on my life. I've had the privilege to study with a rabbi at Northwest Yeshiva High School in Seattle. And about 2 years ago, that yeshiva hired a new assistant administrator. The young man in Jerusalem, his name was Elisha Paul. And to my great surprise, out of all the places in the world to show up, Rabbi Elisha Paul showed up as the assistant administrator at Northwest Yeshiva High School. And I had the privilege to get back in contact with him and tell him about the long-term effect of his good deed that he had done so many years before. So I say that to tell you there's so many things that we do and we think, oh, does it really make a difference? You never know what the long-term effect of something that you do can be. So thank you very much for the chance to be here.
Thank you.